It is my great pleasure to welcome writer and public theologian Dante Stewart to Religion 5009, a graduate seminar called Theologies of Resistance and Reconciliation, a seminar in the UVA Department of Religious Studies that today we open to a wider public audience. Reverend Stewart, if I may, will talk today about his new memoir, Shouting in the Fire, an American epistle that recently appeared with Convergence / Penguin in a beautiful hardback edition that really feels good in the hands to read. You know, it's just a lovely production. Robert P. Jones, the New York Times bestselling author of The Prophets, among other important titles, said of Dante's astonishing literary debut, "Only once in a lifetime do we come across a writer like Dante Stewart, so young and yet so masterful with the pen. This work is a thing to make dungeons shake and hearts thunder." I love that. Well, I am excited about Dante's visit with us today, and to what I expect will be a generative exchange on matters that remain urgent, persistent, and confounding to us all. Only 29 years old, Dante Stewart has emerged really in the past year as an uncommonly focused and fearless public intellectual. His work covers race, religion, politics, and popular culture, and his commentary has been featured on CNN and in the Washington Post, Christianity Today, Sojourners, the magazine Comment, and not to be forgotten, the great collaborative work called The Witness, a Black Christian collective, which one of our fellow travelers, now Dr. Jamar Tisby, is a part of. Dante's recent essay, which I would like to provide you with a link with sometime in today's session, "How I Learned That Jesus is Black," inspired, shall we say, exuberant debate in the weeks after its appearance in the New York Times on Sunday, October 18th. And as an essay, it also attests to the power of James Cone's theological writings to speak to a younger generation of activists and thinkers. In this book, Shouting in the Fire, Mr. Stewart gives breathtaking language to his reckoning with the legacy of white supremacy, both the kind that hangs over our country and the kind that is internalized on a molecular level. He uses his personal experiences as a vehicle to reclaim and reimagine spiritual virtues like rage, resilience, and remembrance, and explores how these virtues might function as a work of love against an unjust, unloving world. We were talking earlier today on the phone, and I told Dante that the memoir, Shouting in the Fire, an American Epistle, strikes me as something new, at least in the past several decades of spiritual and literary memoir. While it has elements of the conversion narrative, of the edifying testimonial, and more recently of the dear white Christian, dear white evangelical, dear white American trope, Shouting in the Fire's singular effect and the power of its story clusters, in my experience, around a narrative structure that disrupts the comforts of linear storytelling, around a narrative structure that also tests the limits of the sermonic voice to render in language the visceral, you know, the particular, the unassimilatable singularities of Black rage and the Black American experience, the idiosyncrasies of the molecular level. As I've read the book and sort of journeyed with it this week, I've been convicted of the, you know, white liberal conceit, and that may have a special intensity as a white Southerner, that I think I know what's coming here when I pick up a book titled Shouting in the Fire, An American Epistle. But in fact, as I've read and experienced the book this week and listened, in addition to reading, to Dante's brilliant performance as the narrator of the spoken word edition of this book, which I highly recommend, I have been left dazzled and dismayed, angered and anguished, edified and broken. And in the margin of the book, I've written a chorus of amens and damns, yeses and woes, and a few share of noes. And the thing is, I was not expecting to hear the Lion of Zion roaring in these pages with the tenderness of a father who stands over the bed of his 2-year-old son and thinks, I have been thinking so much lately about your future and our future together. And because of all of this, my heart is filled with gratitude for your book, for your gifts, for your fearlessness, for your courage, for your voice, and for your visit with us this afternoon. So welcome, Dante Stewart.
Yo, thank you. Thank you, Dr. Charles. It is indeed a wonderful pleasure to be with each of you. And I mean, you hyped me up pretty good. So that was pretty incredible. That made me feel very, very good. So thank you to each of you who are here in this moment and here in this time, to many of the students, to do I say Dr. Aiken?
Dr. Aiken,
right? Okay, cool. Dr. Aiken, thank you for holding it down. And many of you who chose to join us in this moment. So I am a better talker than I am, you know, in some sense, a writer. You know, I'm really decent at writing, but when it comes to things like this, I love, as my brother Jason Reynolds, who's the incredible writer, Jason, I like to be very conversational. And if I do get preachy, it's just kind of woven into my very bones and in my stomach and in my throat. So forgive me, or in some sense, you know, do not forgive me, but embrace it. But yeah. I want to start a little bit. Y'all already read the essay, the New York Times essay. So I'm going to read a little bit from a different little section. So I'm going to read a little bit. I'm going to talk a little bit. Then we're going to talk, a good little lot. So, I was given an interview, and in this interview, they asked me, they was like, yo, like you talk about your grandmother, you talk about your grandfather, you talk about your mama, you talk about your daddy, you talk about Black folk, you talk about white folk, you talk about being young and Black, you talk about, dying, you talk about loving and living and things like that. He was like, yo, like where you want to begin, you know, in your story. So I told him, I was like, you know, I'm Southern. I'm from the Black rural South. So I want to begin at home. Y'all met me in the essay at the White Evangelical Church. Most of that essay was kind of written out of that experience in that, from that 2016 to about 2017, 2018 moment. I want to kind of talk a little bit about home to give another kind of vignette into my own life, into my own story. Is that cool? That's good. If we was in person together, y'all would be able to talk back to me, but it's all good. You can kind of wave your hand, give me a little emoji sign, you know, drop a little red heart or orange heart or fire sign. for my book or something like that. So I'm going to read a little bit, and we're going to talk a little bit, and then we're going to do it like that. So, hey, Ma, I said as I was about to make my plans to go visit the church, how's Bishop doing? He's not doing well, she told me. I could tell her voice was changing and wasn't good. You need to come back home and see Bishop, she said. I am. When? I make a trip in the next few days. Let me see how COVID is going to pan out and I'll come, I told her. Okay. Make sure you come now. All right. I will. I love you. I love you too, son. I never got to see Bishop. He died before I got to. When I heard the news, I felt a deep regret. It wasn't just because I didn't get to see him. It was because I didn't get to tell him how much I appreciated him and loved him for all the ways he really tried to love me. By filling up my gas when I came home, by slipping me a few dollars for groceries, by asking about me, by telling my mom and my daddy how proud he was that I made it out and I had made good on the lessons that all of them taught us. He was so proud of me. I was really grateful. I had grown up. I had seen that all they were doing was trying to make do with the best they had. I knew that they had gone through and what they'd gone through, what this country had made them and how they did not believe it. I knew that he tried, and I never really got to tell him thank you. His last memory of me was playing football at Clemson University, returning back home over a few years, slowly and slowly moving further away and never returning again. My last memory of him, me walking into the church to see his cold, weary, dead black body, just like my Uncle Samson's cold, weary, dead black body, just like Alton Sterling's cold, weary, dead black body, just like Philando Castile's cold, weary, dead black body. When I saw all the old folk and all the old saints and their shocked faces as I entered the church, I took off my hat, the reflection of his life playing in the background, and I removed my glasses. The tears began to fall. I walked up to his body. I put my hand on his hand. I whispered to myself a little prayer. Somehow I needed to honor him and keep his memory alive in my heart. For y'all who follow along, it's on page 127. I just saw you. My bad. Page 127. I'm on the back end. I needed to show him that I learned, though a little too late, but I had learned what it meant to have black faith and what it meant to love us deeply. I told him how much I learned, how much I had seen his faith in the face of such brutality. It was too late, but I learned. I took my hand off him. I walked out the door. My grandmother asked me to take her home. On the way to her house, we started laughing over stories of Bishop, stories of ourselves, stories of this country. We laughed and we laughed and we laughed and we laughed. I dropped her off, told her I love her, and then headed back home. On my way home, I cried because I knew that this was normal. That was faith. Things impossible can become reality. Things oppressive can become just. Things unlovable can become new. And things dead can become alive. The meaning was in the living and the moving and the having our being. The faith within the last and in the joy and in the dying and in the living. I used to think talking about black life or even black faith was about convincing white people to be better. But that's far too limiting. No, I've learned that talking about blackness is about giving us words, setting our bodies free, living in ways that we feel seen and inspired and protected. It is about deep love, the kind that sees what our ancestors did for us, the kind that enables us to become the kinds of ancestors they were to us, and the kinds of ancestors they would have us become. It is about speaking deeply to our pain and to our trauma, but also bringing out our complexity and our beauty. After all, we are human. It is not about triumph as much as it is about telling our story, living in and loving our blackness, being honest. Life is not just about fighting. It is also love. The way we showed up around the dinner table in praise breaks and shout tracks, prayer meetings smelling like musk and perfume, the anointed oil pressing my forehead with the sign of the cross, basketball games on dirt courts, Olympics on concrete, livers and hot sauce, choir meeting up at Ryan's at the church conventions, being in church singing songs all day, all night, learning Bible studies, our heads being grasped by sweaty hands as they pray for our futures, our bodies being held as tight as newborn babies. We were not concerned about what white people thought in those moments. We were too busy living. Learning to love. Ordinary. Hallowed. Deep. Enduring. Unyielding. Unfailing love. We black boys and black girls bonded over black lyrics, notebooks in our hands full of love songs to our black mothers and our black fathers and our black sisters and our black brothers. These were our spirituals. Life and the living was an epistle, a love note. Black teachers showed black kids black Malcolm. Black preachers hooping and hollering about black Jesus. Black aunties and black uncles dancing, holding beer and liquor in their black hands. It was about us. Always about us. All of this told a different story in the white world. We had not believed it. We didn't believe we were niggas. We knew us. We knew the beauty. They might not have, but we knew. We have to love our wounded bodies and our broken spirits and love them back whole again. Our beautiful, complex, contorted bodies, the myriad of human giftedness told us a story that we must never forget, ever. You are here. You are here to be loved and to be loved and to be loved. Very deeply. The proof is not in the histories or the arguments. No, the proof is in our black bodies wrapped up in a poetic love song of survival, shouting and dancing and being embraced and being free and being loved. Minds drawn from deep love like black whales and black woods and old country rural towns, driving down back roads and talking about dead bishops and alive black bodies, creating memories and meaning in a country that tried to rip it away from us, tarrying in the midnight, in the middle of the night, calling on Jesus like a friend and a savior. Our hearts have become the song for the many babies who cried and cried when their mamas and daddies were taken from them, the unspoken prayer. Putting on our Sunday's best, smelling like old perfume with pink hats and long skirts with stockings in the middle of the summer. Trading in our oversized suits for work boots and denim outfits just to provide for our family. Finding somehow in the ugliness of it all, the voices of the ancestors crying out to us that you must live. You must live. You must live and be free. All right, cool. All right, let's talk a little bit. So, hope you enjoyed that reading. Some of that, you know, I kind of riffed off on. That was not in the book. So, if you were following along, forgive me. It was just, you know, whatever. But I wanted to think, you know, particularly, you know, this talk is centered around white evangelicalism and, in some sense, what it does to us in general. But particularly my story as it relates to what white evangelicalism does to us in particular. So in general and particular. And so much of my story begins back home. That so much of back home, whether that was I was raised in the Black Pentecostal church. And as you heard that little narrative read, there is so much of familiarity that was tied to the way our house felt and the way that, you know, it smelled or the way that the concrete felt beneath our feet or whatever way, you know, we created life and things like that. So much of me going into white evangelicalism, as you read about in college. So I began to go to white evangelicalism in college. I was raised in the Black rural South, but I ended up going to Clemson and, you know, just like UVA, if you got, you got the Fellowship of Christian Athletes and things like that and Campus Crusades. And usually these parachurch organizations are in closest proximity to us. But the only thing about that is I used to think that proximity would make people become better. I used to think that proximity would make people more moral, more kind, and more compassionate. But proximity does not change anything if it is not dealing with the power dynamics to which we live and move and have our being in. What do I mean? That oftentimes in these white Christian spaces, so much of the power is reduced to what white people think and what white people say, and particularly the ways in which the space inherits the story that at the center of God's creation, at the center of Christian faith, at the center of what it means to be American and citizen and whose value in the eyes of the law, oftentimes that's reduced to whiteness. It's oftentimes reduced to what white people think, what white people feel, what white people go through. And what I wanted to do in my book is, in some sense, take back that story that was stolen from me. And so much of my own understanding of my own story is not just simply rooted in, you know, Luke chapter 4 and this idea of Jesus saying, you know, hey, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me to preach good news to the oppressed and to set the captives free. That was cool, right? And I needed that at one moment, particularly as it relates to when Alton Sterling and Philando Castile were murdered. I'll never forget, particularly Alton Sterling, when I saw and heard, as I was writing my book, I kind of put on the hat of an investigative journalist. And I spent hours researching everything surrounding Alton Sterling. And I forced myself to listen back to the audio of moments before, moments during, and moments after he was murdered. And that brings the question, how does one, in some sense, see Black death? And what does Black death represent for us, particularly for you? You know, in this moment where we are caught in between two trials, the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse, who is a young man, and a man nonetheless, who is treated as a kid in the eyes of the law, who a judge who holds the power to determine, in some sense, who holds determinative power in so many cases in this society. This judge stands on, in his, the very performance of his duty, this judge stands often not in opposition to this idea of white power and white male innocence that Cal Rittenhouse embodies. But this judge stands on the side of that type of performance. But then we're caught in the trial of Ahmaud Arbery, the trial of the murderers of Ahmaud Arbery, George and Travis McMichael and William Bryan, who follows behind them and filmed this murder. And I would even indeed call it an execution. And even to use the language that Ida B. Wells Barnett or James Cone use, Ahmaud Arbery is caught on the lynching tree. And so for me, when I was in white evangelicalism, there was a point in time, you know, where I was deeply invested with the ideal that whiteness is the standard and whiteness is the goal and whiteness is right. But when you have to see and look and gaze upon somebody who looks like you, whose story is caught in between death and destruction, whose story is oftentimes determined not simply by the individual choices that they make, but the institutional realities that shape and form our lives, what does it mean to gaze or look upon Black death? And that was the conundrum that I found myself in. You know, I'll never forget. I'm looking at Alton Sterling. I'm looking at Philando Castile, who's the day after. And then I am caught between this kind of complexity and confusion. How do I look upon this moment? How do I think about their reality? And for me, if it was up to me during that time while I was in white evangelicalism, I would have done what I did during the when those in Charleston were murdered. I would have done what I did when Mike Brown was murdered, which I was the one who, in some sense, was like the Black conservative who said that those who are on the streets are not preaching the gospel, are not standing up for Jesus, but they're Marxists. They're social justice warriors. And so I had believed a lie that white people who murder must be seen in the best light, and Black people who protest murder must be seen in the worst. And I believed the lie that whiteness must be seen with purity and innocence, and Blackness must be seen through a lens of skepticism and being problematic. And so what changed? What happened? When those two murders happened, first thing that happened was I was confused. I was inside of this space where I was teaching, preaching, leading in white evangelical spaces. And oftentimes to be black and to be in those white spaces, whether you're in progressive or whether you're in conservative spaces, is oftentimes to inherit a story that to be in these spaces will take you closer to success. It will protect you in a world that is oftentimes against you. It will affirm you in ways that you have been wounded. It will give you resources without which you would not have if you stayed where you are. And so I was in that space, caught up in that space, doing whatever, you know, that I do in that space. And then these murders happen. And then I start to go to the leadership. And instead of responding in compassion and empathy and honesty, they responded in apathy and hostility. So then I had a choice. I either stay and be pissed. I either stay and remain invested, or I leave and become different and take on a better story than the story that was handed to me. So why do we remain in these spaces that oftentimes are okay with the benefits of our presence, but oftentimes apathetic to the fullness of our humanity? Why do we remain? I don't know. Maybe like some of us, we are like Nella Larson's, we are like Nella Larson's 1929 novella, Passing. If you haven't seen it, check out The Joint on Netflix. But also if you have not read it, make sure you read Nella Larson's, novella, Passing, where oftentimes in order to cope with the, realities and the violent realities of a racialized society, we oftentimes escape into spaces that can hide who we really are in hopes that it will heal who we're not. And so for me, in order to escape or to be rewarded and this and that, I remain in this space. But then God had other things. Then I was on this, I'll never forget, leading this group, preaching, teaching, leading. And my boy Drew Hall, I'm not at this point, I'm pissed off with this white space. I'm invested, but I'm not the hero of the story. I'm not the person, you know, who these deaths happen and things like that. And then I just end up changing. For me, what this represented was a gradual process of change. And that's the reality about change. Change is oftentimes messy. Change is oftentimes slow. But change should not be an excuse in some sense. This idea of the messiness of change or the slowness of change should not be an excuse or justification to remain around people who do not want to see you as fully human, but who oftentimes whose reality, whose theology is rooted in your erasure. And for me, I did not want to be erased anymore. I did not want to be unseen and unloved. And so Drew Hall, my white friend, Drew Hall, big brother from Georgia, gave me a copy of Martin Luther King's Where Do We Go From Here? I get this copy of Where Do We Go From Here? Read that joint. Martin Luther King quotes James Baldwin. I get The Fire Next Time, which I have the actual copy that I read back then in 2017. I get The Fire Next Time and I read Baldwin's letter to his nephew. And he says, you must believe that what they cause you to endure, that what they do and what they cause you to endure is not a testament to your inferiority, but it is a testament to their insecurity and their fear. And so for me, when I heard that, as is the name of that chapter, my dungeon shook and my chains fell off and my Jesus became black and it was time to run a different way. And the question becomes, what do you do in that moment? How do you change? How do you take on a different story? How does one look at Black death in ways that's not trauma porn or voyeuristic? But how does one gaze upon Black death, not from the white gaze that just seems to reduce our deaths to lessons, to make white people more moral, to make these institutions more beneficial, to bring some type of benefit to the institution just simply because of the conversations that they're having? How does one gaze upon our deaths in order to embrace the fullness of our life? And for me, that meant going back to the Black text. That meant going back to our bodies and trying to figure out what do our bodies hold that can teach us something that will offer, as Charles Mills, the late Charles Mills, God rest his soul. Charles Mills said, how does one encounter and embody an alternative epistemology? I guess I'm now speaking your language in the ethical, in ethical leadership and moral principles. How does one embody and engage in an alternative epistemology that will allow one to embody an alternative ethical reality? And that is the crux of narrative ethics, whether one is dealing with the life of whether one is, as Sister Dorothy would say, whether one is thinking about God. Whether one is trying to think about theology, or whether if you're thinking about Martin Luther King, whether one is thinking about, you know, where do we go from here? Or if one is thinking about thinking with James Baldwin and wondering how does one live in and survive and even shout and even dance within the fire? Or if one is thinking with Toni Morrison, how does one escape the damning reality of this world and embody a paradise that is not just simply an abstract principle, but a life-giving reality? Or to think with Tony K. Bambara, what is the lessons that is built within the society that we live in, and what we see and what we feel and what we taste? Or if one, as my favorite, Alice Walker, if one is to not pass by the purple in the field and piss God off, but notice it and embody what God desires, how does one do that? I am not a sage. I am not a magician. I love to read and I love books. I love the Bible. I'm a practical dude. I can't give you the answers. I don't know any answers. I just know how to wrestle. And I can only tell you the type of life, the type of love, the type of liberation that have come out of my own wrestling. Octavia Butler, the great novelist, had a student come to her and ask. He said he was reading her parables, Parable of the Sower and Parable of the Talent, which I hope many of you read. He was reading the parables and he asked Octavia Butler. He said, yo, Professor Butler, is the world as bad as you make it seem? I take a laugh, and she told the student that I did not bring these bad things and bring them about. I just looked at what was happening right now in our society, and I allowed them to go 30 years into the future, to go from danger into full-fledged disaster. And the student noticeably shaken up, as many of us are shaken up right now, as we are caught in a post quote unquote Donald Trump world, or as we are caught in a world right now that is living in the middle of a pandemic, even if many people have tried to move beyond it, as many people, even right now, many people on this call hold in their bodies the reality of those whom we lost and the things that we try to remember and the things that we try to hold on to. As we are, as that student living in this moment, wondering, what do we do? Where do we go? How do we become ethical leaders? How do we become moral practitioners? How do we become the best of our traditions? As the student asked, what do we do? And Octavia Butler just simply answered the young man. She said, there is no singular answer. There are many answers, many possibilities, and you can become one if you so choose. And so how did Dante Stewart, the Black conservative, upholding John Piper and John MacArthur and the worst of white evangelicalism, become who Dante is right now? First of all, I had to deal honestly with myself. When one comes to shouting in the fire, an American epistle. One of the things that I wanted to do in inspiration of Kiese Layman, Heavy, in inspiration of Jasmine Ward's Men We Reap, in inspiration of The Yellow House by Sarah Broom, in inspiration of James Baldwin, in inspiration of many other Black writers, I wanted this text to be an honest and vulnerable text. Because I knew that to write memoir and the discipline of memoir, which is simply the body being able to be felt on the page, to be touched and to be grasped, That is the craft of memoir. Is one taking one story, what one remembers, or as Toni Morrison in her Tanner lecture calls it, one is able to feel and look upon and gaze at the sight of memory and are able to handle it and do whatever one does with it. I wanted to tell an honest and vulnerable story that did not make me the hero of the story, but just simply made me the one who tells it. Because none of us, in some sense, can become who we are. If I'm leaning on the stories of antiquity, none of us can become who we are by simply embodying a Herculean journey that looks at us and gazes upon us as if we are simply the hero. Every single one of us, no matter who we are, journeys are Odyssean. Our journeys are caught between immaturity and immobility. Our journeys are caught between failure and disgust. Our journeys are often caught between waywardness and misguided ambition. But our journeys also capture love, beauty, complexity, and creativity. And so what I had to do, I had to go back into my own story. For the body is, whether we believe it or not, an epistle of love and knowledge and memory. But the second thing I had to do was not just go back to my black body, but I had to go back to my black text. As many people read me, they will, at some point you're going to realize that I actually am somebody who wants to expand the canon. I am not one who simply says that God is done speaking. I think to say that God is done speaking and to speak in arrogant notions of our own kind of epistemological arrogance is to, in some sense, say that we are in the place of God, and to say that, in some sense, that to determine God's speaking and where God speaks is to exist in a power dynamic where one is able to control body and story and narrative. And if anything, if the black text does anything, it allows one to move beyond the white gaze, whether it is of white society, whether it is of white violence and of white terrorism and white limited imagination. And one is able to go into, as W.E.B. Du Bois call, goes behind the veil. Or one is able to travel away from the world of the white man, or as the brilliant Audre Lorde writes, she says this. She says, the white fathers told us, I think, therefore I am. But the black mother, the poet within each of us, whispers in our dream, I feel, therefore I can be free. And so what does this represent? The black text represents an alternative way of feeling and being free, where one is able to enter the black interior, right? Charles, you actually said that Audre Lorde said, as in poetry is not luxury, by Audre Lorde and Sister Outsiders, around the fourth or fifth page in Sister Outsider. So one is able to go into what Elizabeth Alexander calls the black interior. And what is the black interior? It is simply what I gave you in the reading. And I read that particularly reading because I don't want any of us to walk away thinking about black life in this country, or even our experience in white evangelicalism or white society or white religion, just thinking simply that black life is reducible to white racism or the resistance to it. As many of us found out in 2020, when it came to the politics of publishing, the story that just simply positioned itself as teaching white people to become more moral, or in some sense, what white people made the anti-racist text. I'm not talking about what black people think about ourselves and what Angela Davis mean by anti-racism, which is struggling against the forms of domination in our society that allows whiteness to function with a godlike force. What I mean is the type of anti-racism that white people created as in a vacuum to teach white people simply how to have better conversations with themselves, amongst themselves. But as Tarana Burke asks, many of them talked about anti-racism, but many did not, as she says, ask, what does it do to us as black people? What does it do? How does it feel in our body and in our stomachs and in our eyes and in our hands. What is white racism? What is racism? What is gender violence? What is transphobia? What is homophobia? What is sexual assault? What is all the myriad and intersecting ways of power and power dynamics, as Patricia Hill Collins talks about? How does these interlocking, intersecting systems of power harms us and hates us? I didn't want to talk about that. I wanted you and me to enter into the black interior, where Elizabeth Alexander says, we envision what we are not meant to envision. Beautiful, complex black cells, real and enactable black power, rampant and unfetishized black beauty. So I did not just have to go to the black body, nor did I have to go simply to the black text. But I had to go to the black text in ways to ask the ancestors, what do you have to say to me? What are you speaking to me? Unless you question my theology and think that my theology is a little whack or whatnot, let me give you a little bit of theology real quick. I'm at Emory University. I'm doing work at the intersection of black text, theory, and theology. Wondering the question, particularly around James Baldwin, what can we gain by doing a close theological reading of black literature in general, but Baldwin's text in particular? Particularly, what can we learn about faith and embodiment and performance and gender and sexuality and politics and theology? As a up-and-coming theologian, I want to take, and I wanted to take, black text seriously as sacred texts in the Bible. This anthology, not to be confused with basic instructions before leaving Earth, but to be thought about as boundless illustrations becoming lived experiences in this anthology, this collection of books. This book, this anthology of liberation and loss, of pain and trauma, of imagining and dreaming, of violence and dispossession. It has people names. And we as people, those in the tradition of faith who call ourselves Christian, we receive these names as divine revelation to teach us something about life and about God and about the world that we live in. To teach us about something about the stories that give us meaning. Nehemiah, Isaiah, Daniel, Hosea. And for me, I didn't just want to receive those stories, but I wanted to receive black names and ask, what is the book of Baldwin, or the book of Tony, or the book of Alice Walker, or the book of Morrison have to teach me about the Bible, about the black body, about the bullet, about the badge, about the gavel, about the ground on which we live, about the church? What does it mean to read these people's writing as something sacred that can teach us, teach me about how to be black in the world? And so, going back to black texts, reading it critically and theologically, I saw, as Dr. Yosef Surrett argues, that black literature is indeed religious literature. It is not cut off from the black church. If you read The Fire Next Time, you can read The Fire Next Time, the beginning as a prayer and the second half as a sermon. In the tradition of Baldwin, black texts are not cut off from the church, but they're a very extension of it, even as they criticize the church. So as Jesus would say, the enemy comes to steal, kill, and destroy. But I have come that you may have life and life to the full. And so doing a close theological reading of Bambara or Morrison, going into their worlds, I wanted to say that black literature and black life and black love and black creativity expands theological imagination, because it disarms theology from being a weapon to be wielded against ourselves and the world we live in and the people whom we relate to. But it rearms, in some sense, dismantles and deconstructs theology from that way of being and opens up theological imagination to see not as a weapon to be wielded or armed or function as a weapon against others, but as a world to be explored that can help me open up and embrace and explore lastly what I had to go to is the Black world. When I wrote my book, in some sense, my book can be an exercise in Black love making and Black world making. That we do not just simply live in the white world. We have a world of our own. We do not simply just exist in a matrix of violence. We are not just simply touched and touching a society that does not see us as human. As I wrote in the essay in the New York Times, I am Black alive and looking back at you. The poet June Jordan writes, I remember the first time I became an alive Black body. I remember it all. I remember what I told myself and try to tell others in as many creatively Black ways as I possibly can. We do not just die. We do not just suffer. We do not just fail. We do not just grieve. We live. We dance. We love. We shout. Shout in the fire.
Cool.
And we can talk. Hope I ain't bore you to death. Let's do it.
You should now be able to unmute yourself if you'd like to ask a question.
Dante, I just wanted to say thank you so much for that reading and for what you're doing. I don't have much to add. I just want to say one thing that I kept thinking. I was glad you mentioned Kiese Layman because I kept hearing echoes of that writing in the abundance of the vocabulary even. And one thing I think you're doing that's so important is I think when we're talking about theology, it is there's thinking about God, but it's human beings thinking about God. And the trouble is when human beings think they are God and make themselves God. But part of what you're doing, I think, in some ways in recovering Black texts, is you're saying it's only when we are embodied humans that we can properly even think about God or experience God. And you do that even in the way that you are bringing liturgy into the mouth, you know, living and moving and having being. And I just think there's something interesting about not looking for God necessarily in the sacred text, but looking for humanity in the sacred text, which is how we approach God to begin with. And so thank you so much for your work.
Yeah, that's real. That's real. Thank you, Ashley, for that, because in some sense, that was like, you know, this idea about thinking about God and what texts in some sense are like authority. And I just want to simply think about authority, not simply in a hierarchy, but authority as something arising out of a community to help them make meaning in their story. So I'm not fond of much of, you know, traditions about ideas of authority, because I feel like they're just wielded for power and hierarchy. You know, y'all know Christian history enough. Authority was always, you know, followed easily by some type of violence and death. But when I think about authority and this authority of Black texts, you know, I needed something beyond just simply the ways in which, like, I was taught either in white evangelical seminaries to read texts, particularly biblical texts, but also, you know, the ways in which many people in the religious space, whether it be religious studies or theology, many times people's idea of hermeneutical, the principles and the practices of hermeneutics are oftentimes arise not out of the frameworks of literary theory and literary studies, but they're super kind of imposed from theological studies, which literary studies asks the question, the first question of literary studies is, what does the text say? The first question of theological studies is, what does God say? If I can reduce it to that, you know, if I could just simply reduce it to that framework. And so in some sense, like, you know, when I kind of got into the literary studies, I started to see that, like, arising, just simply listening to what Black texts were saying, in some sense, taught me so much. Like, Dr., if y'all get a chance, read Fair Jasmine Griffin's new book, Read Until You Understand, The Profound Wisdom of Black Life and Literature. If you get a chance, read that book. She looks at these kind of themes in Black literature, whether that's rage and love, and rage plays a gigantic part in my understanding of the deconstruction of theology, theological principles, and even the reintroduction of my faith and the renewal and the resurrection of faith, even if there was discontinuity from that which came before, arose out of my reading closely of these Black texts, not just simply as great texts to read to complete a story, to complete a list, but I needed these texts for life. The same way that we are taught to approach the biblical text to help us root and ground our spirituality and expand our ideas of our identity was the same way I related to Kiese's word or Jasmine word or N.K. Jameson or Toni Morrison or Alice Walker or Jean Toomer and things like that. And just all these, I'm just surrounded by so many books and to just name just so many ways in which their voices inform what I do. And I think so often, you know, I think there's great liberation in expanding our ideas of what texts can generate meaning for us. And how does those texts shape and form how we think about ourselves, how we think about our bodies, how we think about society we live in, and how do we name those experiences, and how do we perform our faith or perform our ethics or perform love or re-understand it? So I'm in a ethical leadership class right now with Dr. Walter Fluker. And one of the things he talks about is the raconteur. And the raconteur is a storyteller. So it's narrative ethics, that the ethical imagination or principles in which we want to embody is often generated around this idea of story. And everybody brings a story to the text, or whether it be the text of our country, the text of our bodies, the text of our religion, the text of our relationships, whatever. These are all living texts that has ideas and principles and practices rooted up in them. And one of the things of the raconteur is to ask the question, how can we recollect the past and how can we recollect in the present? So doing the work of Toni Morrison, how does one imagine, how does one ponder what is actual and imagine what is possible? So the task of the raconteur or the storyteller or the scribe or the artist is in some sense to understand what's going on in the present, critically evaluate the traditions and the theories and the ideas of the past, being connected to them, but not being beholden to them, while also being able to imagine alternative futures for all of us. And so I think for me, Black text, what that did for me was to reimagine faith, vulnerability, honesty, rage, love, liberation, whatever. It gave me new language or whatnot. And I think as Tony K. Bambara is right, that I learned how to make revolution either inside of myself or even in the text, something that was irresistible.
I would like to say that your lecture was very wonderful. And I would definitely maintain that it does speak to me as a Filipino when it comes to looking back at one's heritage and at one's past. And there's this wonderful quote that is imbibed in our cultural tradition. It's, he who does not know how to look back at where they came from will never get to their destination. And I believe that in many ways what your writings clearly demonstrate is that a sense of liberation, empowerment, and tranquility arises when we begin to embrace our identity, and that means going deep into our roots and into our own past. And for me, I think there is some level of understanding that I have when I hear your lectures. It's when I heard your discussion, although I am not of a tradition or a background, there's a way in which I could understand based on shared experiences from the past. And there's a lot of tranquility and empowerment that arises when struggles are shared in many ways.
Indeed, indeed, indeed. And I would, you know, I've been reading a lot of bell hooks. And one of the things I think, you know, no matter where we come from, I feel like in some sense, the more I think about the kind of colonization and the long history of colonial project that so many brilliant scholars speak to, that so many of us are bound to inheriting a world that is so deeply rooted, especially in modernity, so deeply rooted in a project that has almost been, to use the language of cosmological. So whiteness has functioned in the world with a kind of godlike totalizing force that collapses bodies and lands and peoples together. And we have inherited this world in which we have to try and make sense of it and make meaning and identity in ways, you know, that we oftentimes don't have language for. That's why I think, you know, it's critical, as bell hooks talks about, is this kind of project of decolonization, this project of going back into our own stories, back into our own communities, figuring out how does one think about what type of knowledge production arises out of our community. So for me, in Black text, what kind of knowledge production arises out of Black text? And how does Black life and Black text represent a critical place to think about the world and not just something to be exploited? And so I think everybody, even white folks, should be doing that critical work, because we have to imagine alternative worlds beyond the logics of colonization, which has informed so much of our society and the ways in which we function on a societal level. Even if we're not consciously aware of it, so many of these kind of practices and modes of being in the world kind of functions that way. And I think each one of us must go back, you know, to the mother tongue. Like Audre Lorde says, that the white fathers told us, "I think, therefore I am." What is she speaking to? She's speaking to, if we think about it, the white father. So it is this entity named, it's a plurality of entity named that stands outside of us as an authority beyond us. The white fathers told us. So there's a hierarchy. There's a distance between us and these supposedly white fathers. They told us, "I think, therefore I am." So the wealth of knowledge is cognitive, that it is only in the mind. And hasn't Christianity a function in the world that seemed to suggest, you know, and even the ways in which faith and politics have destroyed people and boundaries and land, have said that the spiritual life, that the life of the mind is the most important, while disregarding the experience of the body. And this functions rightly. If you dislodge what someone holds in their bodies from what we think about our heads and reason with our heads, then you can easily commit, as I think either Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel or Ella Wiesel or somebody said it, that if I could get people to believe absurdities, then I could get them to commit atrocities. So Audre Lorde is saying these white fathers function outside of us in a sort of absurd logic that says that we have the authority to tell the world how to function. But the Black mother within each of us, not standing outside of us, but there is somebody inside of us, the Black mother, the poet And what is just poetry? Poetry is not this stagnant language, but it's flexible. It's functional. It arises from our experience. It can be bent and move and not rigid. It does not depend on an outside authority for its power and legitimacy in the world. But the Black mother within us, the poet, whispers in our dreams, I feel, therefore I can be free. And oftentimes, too often, whiteness has functioned in the world to say, you are not human. You do not feel. You do not think. You do not know. So as a symbol, the Black mother, as Audre Lorde uses, I think each of us should think about what symbol, what mother tongue, what alternative story, as somebody said, what indigenous knowledge arises from our story that whispers into our dreams, that when we wake up, we have an alternative consciousness that allows us to function in the world with the idea of freedom that we know can be ours.
Well, may I ask a question?
Go ahead.
Well, this is just so amazing. Thank you. And when you come and do your doctorate at UVA, we can put together a group of scholars and thinkers to help sort through this project that you've precisely envisioned of a new epistemological framework. And I think part of the project of white supremacy in the West has been tied in to patterns of thought that are codified philosophically in constructions of systems, and systems that are totalizing, and systems that privilege a kind of world constitutive, marauding, all-consuming ego. And so the discourse of philosophers, Christian and Jewish, that include Bonhoeffer and Simone Weil and Buber and the Frankfurt School, who are trying to resist that kind of Hegelian presumption to world mastery, which is the kind of motor of colonization. It's a motor of also quashing the individual singularity of experience, and I think also of bodily life. Anyway, we can talk about that later, but I want to tell you that there's a passage on page 115 that filled me with such enormous sentence envy. It's like, oh my God, that is the best sentence I've read. And it's this opening to a question I wanted to have you kind of think through. But I want us to all look at that passage first, because it's truly, we're talking about expanding the canon. I want to make this a canonical paragraph. It's the middle of page 115, and you write, you're sort of making this break from kind of the white evangelical world. And this is in the wake of the beginning of these, the season of police killings of Black men, and you're on questioning and sort of the response that you're getting from the company. Anyway, if the white folk I worshipped and went to school with and had dinner with had the imagination to see C.S. Lewis's Aslan and the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe as Jesus, then I knew there should have been no problem when Black folks said Jesus was Black and Jesus loved Black people and Jesus wanted to see Black people free. Sadly, to the end of that page, I found out that many could see the symbol of divine goodness and love in an animal before they could see the symbol of divine goodness and love in Blackness. Wow, I mean, that is such a potent kind of, you know, rendering of the sort of, you know, white evangelical mind. And I would like for you to give me some account of what creates that kind of willful or habitual narrow mind, you know, narrowness and blindness. Mm-hmm. You know, Martin Luther King Jr. in left in Birmingham City Jail was looking sort of at white Southern churches in the South, and he said something. He asked this haunting question: you know, who is the God they worship? So maybe you could kind of theologically probe that extraordinary passage with some attention to this this paradox.
Yeah, yeah, and I have to go to the Book of Baldwin to think about. I think with Baldwin, you know, and I think about this question particularly, how is this this idea of, you know, really what I was wrestling with is like both symbolism and epistemology and theology, that literally is in that one sentence or two, three or four sentences. You know, it's me kind of theorizing on the page through sentences. It's like, how can so many people like be taught to in some sense, like be taught and discipled to see whiteness as good and Blackness as bad? That whatever is created, you know, by white people, but particularly the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, even though many people would not racialize that story, and I wouldn't racialize it either, it is written by a white man, you know, and in some sense, those who we are, our social markers, in some sense, shapes and informs our artistic narratives. So we think about art and what art does. Art, in some sense, in many ways, art, as many people call, activism. You know, but it's also the stuff of life and people's kind of dreams and desires. So in some sense, the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe would be C.S. Lewis just is kind of artistic expression. But to do another type of reading of that, of the ways in which people, you don't have just what the artist puts out in the world, but you also have what the artwork becomes in the people who embrace it in their tradition. And many people in the tradition of white evangelicalism do this sort of metaphorical reading of the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, whether that be a true reading or not, whether one believes Aslan is Jesus or not. That symbol of Aslan represents for them, out of their narration of C.S. Lewis's faith, he must have been talking about Jesus, whether he was or not. I don't know, because I haven't done C.S. Lewis studies or read it closely enough. Whether he has or not, that really does not matter in this sense, in the sense of what this story became for people. So yeah. Jesus became the lion and things like that, and represents strength and coming back and resurrection and things like that. So I just wondered if people had the kind of creative cognition to be able to imagine, and not just imagine, but embrace, because there's a difference. There's a difference in naming something and embracing it. So not just simply to imagine, but to embrace the lion as good and Jesus, but then turn around and, you know, turn around and see that, you know, and turn around and not imagine Blackness as good and Jesus as Black, tells more a story about the kind of institutional realities than many people want to admit. So yeah. To go to the Book of Baldwin. Baldwin says,
is it possible for me to just jump in real quickly?
Yeah, go ahead.
That is really helpful. And if I may just ask one question on the response that you're offering here. And it's, when you were in these white congregations, in these white evangelical spaces, and you began to both sort of recognize but also to feel the contradiction between the structures of white evangelical piety and your experiences in as a Black American what became a horrific season of Black death. What did you encounter? What kind of responses were you hearing? Like, what were people saying when you began to ask these questions about? And to say there, if the Christian religion begins with the Savior who was born homeless in a manger, then, why can't we see the presence of Christ in those who, are, brutalized by the powers and the principalities, et cetera, et cetera? I mean, what kind of responses were you getting?
Two type of responses. Number one, apathy. And number two, hostility. So we had to think about to respond to many of the responses that I got, especially as I was kind of getting angry and angrier, and started to actually speak up and was beginning to change. I started reading different, started talking different, I started preaching different. And so then, when I started to bring my angst and my kind of fear and my trepidation in this space, especially with my family and my friends, there was apathy. It was not compassion. It was not suffering with, to think about the Latin rendering of the word. It was not suffering with. It was not feeling pain as Jesus felt within his belly, within the very core of his being, in which altered his own sense of self and identity and placing in the world. If we are to think about feeling something that deeply in the way that Jesus felt it. But it was more so apathy. And so when we think about Blackness inside a white space or inside a white society, there is on the one hand hypervisibility, where we are always conscious, and this just goes for any marginalized community, any society, there's hypervisibility. So if you step in, think about Ahmaud Arbery, the only reason why they chased him is because he was Black. Hypervisibility. Think about Sandra Bland. The only reason why the police officers stop her is because she has a certain type of car and has black skin. So she must be doing something wrong. Hypervisibility. Dylan Roof. The only reason why Dylan Roof goes to Mother Emanuel is because Black people are there. Hypervisibility. Think about President Barack Obama. He is changing our society and we're losing things. Hypervisibility. That's one side of racialization inside of society. But there's also erasure and invisibility, which renders one not just simply less than human, but non-human, to use the language of Becoming Human by the theorist Zakiya Jackson, or J. Cameron Carter, who writes about that as well. There's erasure and invisibility. And whenever you erase someone, you will always be apathetic to what they experience. And so then when I started to speak up, the apathy, I forced them to deal with their apathy. Whether it was through my writing, through my preaching, through my leading, through my being angry in public, through my rage, through the embodiment of that, I forced them out of their apathy, but I could not force them to change in their hostility. Because to be white in this society is to be discipled on a religious level and to be socialized on a theoretical level and an institutional level, to be socialized and to be discipled, to care more about the world that benefits your children then you do care about the world that destroys mine. And even if, as Reinhold Niebuhr cites in Moral Man and Immoral Society, I think it was around, where's my copy? Let me, if I can get my, I'm trying to find my copy. I can't find my copy. Where is it at? Right. Oh, there we go. There we go. Since we're on the topic of Niebuhr, or whatnot, I want to read you something from Niebuhr, on Moral Man and Immoral Society, page 253. He talks about education and conciliation and philanthropy and the difference between charity and justice. And this is relevant to my understanding of apathy and hostility, but also where I want to bring in James Baldwin and why this problem is so enduring, but particularly why for me, I gave up on trying to solve that problem and turned my gaze to Black life and embracing Black life and love. So on page 253, Reinhold Niebuhr is talking about educational and conciliatory enterprises. He says, but education and conciliatory enterprises have the limitations which all such purely rational and moral efforts reveal. Think about Audre Lorde. What did Audre Lorde say? The white fathers told us, I think, therefore I am. So many people think about, if I can think differently, then it's going to change. You know, this kind of idea of hierarchy of knowledge. They operate within a given system of injustice. The Negro schools conducted under the auspices of white philanthropy or white power encourage individual Negroes to higher forms of self-realization. So, to speak of white evangelicalism, you come in here, you talk about unity, you talk about reconciliation, you can come in here, higher forms of self-realization. But they do not, speaking of white people, working under the idea of charity, if you just, you know, we do a little bit here, get a little money, you know, have Black people come speak, you know, and things like that, you know, and that'll change everything. They do not make a frontal attack upon the social injustice from which the Negro suffers. Let's go down a little bit. This means that, matter of fact, they try to enlarge, but they operate nevertheless within the limits of the quote unquote zones of agreement. So this only type of Blackness can function in society. This only type of whatever can function within our church. This means that they secure minimum rights for the Negro, such as better sanitation, police protection, more adequate schools, but they do not touch his, or I would add her, because Niebuhr is very patriarchal, his, her, they, their political disenfranchisement and their economic disinheritance. They hope to do so in the long run, because they have the usual faith and the power of education and moral persuasion to soften the heart of the white man or the white society. This faith is filled with as many illusionist expectations always are. However large the number of individual white men or white women or white society or white educational institutions who do and who will identify completely with the Negro cause, the white race in America will not admit the Negro to equal rights if it is not forced to do so. Upon that point, one may speak with a dogmatism which all history justifies. So what Niebuhr is talking about is this idea of hostility and apathy and the ways in which, if in general, if you don't have this large cohort of white people in society who will change and who will address political disenfranchisement, economic disinheritance, the ways in which, you know, many people think that charity is justice and that education will change people without dealing with power dynamics. If people don't change those concepts, then nothing will change unless they are forced to do so. And for us, too often times that forcing has been at the expense of our life and at the cost of our death. And so for me, I would agree with James Baldwin, where he says, if the concept of God has any validity or any use, it can only make us larger and fewer, freer and more loving. If God cannot do this, then it's time to get rid of him. And for me, I did not want, and I don't think, you know, that persuasion, convincing people of your humanity will solve the issue or would change things. For me, I had to turn my gaze different. So I don't know, in some sense, what will change, you know, this limitation in which my old neighbor writing in 1932 testified to. It's now 2021, going in 2022, almost 100 years later. It is now 90 years later, will be next year, 90 years later, by which Reinhold Niebuhr speaks in this moment. And so I want to turn my gaze as Baldwin and others and Bambara and Octavia Butler to envision, and somebody just put Afrofuturism in the comment chat, and I think that's the case. It is, how do we envision a world where we don't just reduce our lives simply to why white people fail and why white people do this and that? Of course, that's a part of it. It's a part of our literature. We have to deal with white supremacy. But I want to wonder, as Baldwin wonders, in The Fire Next Time, the most important part of The Fire Next Time, the question is, what will happen, as Baldwin writes on the last page of The Fire Next Time, what will happen to all that beauty? For Black people, even though many people are not aware of it and do not know it yet, are very beautiful. So I want to lean on that beauty, not moral persuasion. Yes, let's name that, those limitations, but also let's envision a future beyond simply waiting on the patience of those who benefit from injustice. Sorry I took that long answer, but yeah, hopefully I answered your question.
Thank you. That was terrific. The question that was asked, you've been so exceedingly generous with your time, and we only have a few more minutes, but I'm very intrigued by the question that was asked through chat. I'd like to ask a question to the participant, but perhaps you have a response to this, and that is, could you recommend one or two introductory texts to, like, the discourse of Afrofuturism? I would just like to have a couple of titles and then your response to this.
Yeah. I think for me, like, so I don't – My kind of experience in Afrofuturism is very limited. I deal particularly with, you know, doing close theological reading of Black texts. Of course, that's a part of, like, the tradition of N.K. Jameson, Octavia Butler, Derek Bell. There's actually a really good book right here that I suggest. It is entitled Dark Matter. Dark Matter, A Century of Speculative Fiction from the African Diaspora. There's actually in here a beautiful, 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 essay. They have 100 years of speculative fiction writing, but also, they have critical essays at the back. And I think Walter Mosley wrote the essay. You can't see it, but Walter Mosley wrote the essay in here, Black to the Future. So I would suggest that. I would also suggest N.K. Jameson's short story collection, How Long Till Black Future Month. So I like to give people, you know, now I will say, y'all, I am... My joint is theory, theology, and text, Black text. My joint is not Afrofuturism, but I did cover Afrofuturism in a lecture last semester in my Black Lit class. So Dark Matter, How Long to Black Future Month. But then there is also with Samuel Delaney, I think Trisha Rose and Greg Tate, they did an interview with Mark Derry. Entitled, let me find it right now. So Mark Derry, Afrofuturism. It's called Black to the Future. And it is so I can actually share this in the chat real quick. I could share that in the chat. So it's a conversation on cyberculture, and interviews with Tricia Rose, Greg Tate, and Samuel Delaney around this idea of Afrofuturism. And this right here is where Afrofuturism, this particular writing, this interview that was released, is where the term Afrofuturism found its home in. But then also dimensions of Afrofuturistic thought and gesturing towards Afrofuturistic thought is woven within Black text. When one simply, you know, goes, I mean, even when you read The Fire Next Time, one can make a case that Baldwin is in some sense, one can make a case, you know, that Baldwin is gesturing toward a future, an alternative future where Black life is characterized by beauty and not brutality. So when Baldwin asks the question, what will happen to all that beauty? To ask that question, what will, is to force a question in the present, but force the mind to the future. What will? That connotation is future. What will happen to all that beauty? He sets our gaze not on what will happen to all that brutality. And in the context of that question, the context of that question is him saying this. It is him. Let me go back to it. He says, when I was very young and was dealing with my buddies in those wine and urine stained hallways, something in me wondered what will happen to all that beauty. So Baldwin is not just simply talking about our bodies and our lives, but he's talking about Harlem. What will happen to Harlem? And what did happen to Harlem in the future? Gentrification, the destruction of that beauty and creativity. And people in Harlem, activists and artists and ministry leaders and whatever, people are fighting against it and thinking about this kind of what we're centering on today, thinking about theologies of resistance to create art, to create life, to build businesses, to do these things, to make, as Sadia Hartman says, bare need into an arena of elaboration. Is gesturing toward Afrofuturistic imagination and theological possibility, is to question in the future, what will happen to all that beauty? And to say whatever happens in the future will inform the world that I build in the present. That is Afrofuturism, particularly asking that question, what will happen, not just simply to all that beauty, but what will happen to all that Black beauty? And how can I go to board meetings? How can I change curriculum? How can I, in my department, in my university, in policing, in policy, in whatever, in publishing, in who we throw our weight around to, in who we give our money to, what money we give, how much we give, depending on the race, class, gender, sexuality, ability, religion, geography, those disparities in those realities. How can we make sure that the future that those people exist in, whether it be tomorrow or the next day, or 50 years from now, 100 years from now, is better than the past that they have inherited and the present that they are forced to live in?
Brother Stewart, this has been one of those exchanges that I would call transformative in the course of the semester. And as you know, my own great admiration of this book that has left me thinking about so many basic questions on religion, race, but also, you know, writing into race. And I really love the question you ask about canonicity and expanding the canon. I would like to use my remaining years in some way to make the case for the civil rights movement as canonical theologically. as a theological text that is canonical. And so that invitation to think of this not as any kind of delimitation on our intellectual, our myriad intellectual, you know, endeavors, but as an expansion, is one that what makes me want to shout amen. I, you know, this is just a great gift to us. And I hope this is the beginning of a conversation and, a friendship between the project and UVA and you. I wish you, just, you know, safe travels and blessings on your journeys as you launch this book. I guess you're about, what, 4 weeks into the, that launch period?
Yeah, 4 weeks. Fifth week. Going into the fifth week. This is the fifth week.
Yeah. And, you know, I think this, book, you know, for reasons we were talking about earlier today, may take a little longer to find its audience because it, you know, has this kind of place within Christian writing and, you know, and yet, you know, your sensibilities gravitate towards like the literary memoir and you're doing things at the level of craft and narrative that, are one rarely sees within, you know, popular religious writing. And, I'm still naive enough to believe that the artful prose and, you know, the powerful and the power of a voice, of your voice, together will draw readers in eventually, but it may not happen within that kind of artificial 8-week publicity blast framework that has become like the test now for whether a book, you know, pops or doesn't, which is absurd. Okay. So, thank you. Gratitude, peace, blessings.
Thank you. Do I exit or, I mean, thank you. Cool. Well, great to be with y'all. I do indeed look forward to keeping in touch and many blessings to you. Hope y'all enjoy the book. And yeah, hit me up on social media, you know, and things like that. Like I respond back, you know, I'm very accessible, and things like that. So let's all keep in touch.